From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We have seen throughout this campaign to repeal affirmative action in Washington state that the supporters of I-200 have really played the race card.
A debate on a Washington state initiative that hired out-of-state black signature gatherers to support an anti-affirmative action bill those recruited say they didn't understand. And a look at the Tawana Brawley case, part two. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The white supremacist convicted of assassinating civil rights leader Medgar Evers says he'll appeal a court ruling upholding his conviction. The Mississippi Supreme Court ruled yesterday that Byron de la Beckwith got a fair trial in the 1963 murder, even though more than 30 years had elapsed between the crime and the verdict. Beckwith's attorney says his client now wants to appeal in federal court. Meanwhile, Beckwith's son called yesterday's ruling another stumbling block. The ailing Beckwith is now 77. He's serving a life sentence in a Mississippi prison. The heart of his appeal is that he was denied a fair and speedy trial and that many potential witnesses are dead and evidence was lost. A judge has ruled that the murdered wife of a Nigerian dissident, Mashood Abiola, the elected president of Nigeria, now in prison, can have a New York City street named after her. Over the objections of the Nigerian government, the judge ruled that naming an intersection across from the UN mission, the Nigerian UN mission, Kudirat Abiola Corner, does not mean the city is establishing its own foreign policy. An Icelandic charity said today the United Nations and Iraq had approved its plan to fly Santa Claus to Baghdad on Christmas Day with gifts for Iraqi children hit by UN sanctions. But the group said it still had to ensure that the Russian aircraft it's chartering would be in Reykjavik on time for Santa's planned takeoff on Wednesday, bringing a message of global peace. Newly released films of old nuclear weapons tests detail experiments in the use of atomic explosions for peaceful purposes, like harbors, tunnels, and canals. U.S. Energy Secretary Federico Pena previewed the films with reporters. The films also included footage he described as disturbing, such as radiation tests on pigs and other animals at nuclear test sites during the Cold War. Other footage included then-Attorney General Robert Kennedy putting on eye shades to view a blast at the Nevada test site in 1964. The Energy Department says the tests in the so-called Plowshares program were a technical success, but that nuclear explosions were never actually used for peaceful purposes. Today's release of the previously secret material is part of the Clinton administration's evolving policy of openness at the DOE. It was accompanied by a new rule changes intended to protect whistleblowers. This news from Frankfurt, Germany. Holocaust survivors disrupted the annual meeting in Germany yesterday of a shell company that is the vestige of IG Farben, the firm that made the gas for Hitler's death camps. IG Farben's money belongs to the victims of Auschwitz, read one banner carried by about 120 protesters blocking the entrance to the hall where the mostly elderly shareholders of IG Farben Industry in liquidation had gathered. Several demonstrators who had bought a share in order to be able to attend were thrown out for disrupting the proceedings. Some survivors of the Auschwitz death camp wore their prison numbers. Others wore the yellow star that the Nazis forced Jews to wear. IG Farben, which made Zyklon B gas, was split after the Second World War into three chemical companies, Hext, Bayer, and BASF. The shell company survives in the hope of, albeit dwindling, of reclaiming IG Farben's assets left abroad at the end of the war. Above all, this meant property in East Germany that was nationalized by Soviet occupiers and which IG Farben was not able to try to reclaim until after unification in 1990, and which it's been unsuccessful in trying to claim since. The company had difficulty finding a venue for the meeting because many hotels in Frankfurt feared demonstrations. Congo President Laurent Kabila will reshuffle his government on January 3rd. Speaking on television yesterday after an emergency cabinet meeting, the spokesperson of Kabila, Raphael Genda, said the head of state has said a renovated government team will be set up by January 3rd. Genda said the new team would be sworn in on January 4th. Three screenwriters are suing the makers of the new James Bond movie, Tomorrow Never Dies, saying the whole thing was their idea. Jeffrey Howard, Chris Butler, and Jay Schlossberg-Cohen, in court papers made available yesterday, said their screenplay for a proposed movie called Currency of Fear was stolen by MGM and turned into the latest 007 thriller. And that's some of the news at this hour. It was perhaps the most amazing election in Korea in the century. It was the election on Thursday of Kim Dae-jung. Kim Dae-jung, who was the dissident voice of a generation of South Korean democracy crusaders, elected president. This was a man who was kidnapped by the Korean CIA, accused by the United States of being a North Korean agent, and run over by a truck when he ran for president in an earlier election. Well, now Kim Dae-jung, the president-elect of South Korea, faces a series of tough political choices when he officially takes office in February. Perhaps the most daunting is the recently negotiated $60 billion IMF loan package for South Korea. The deal requires the Asian country to impose sharp austerity measures, measures which will almost certainly engender mass opposition from the very people who supported him. We're joined right now by Bruce Cummings, a professor of East Asian history at the University of Chicago and author of Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, first, just this election of Kim Dae-jung and who he is, what he represents in South Korea. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of his history?
Well, Kim Dae-jung is one of the most experienced political leaders functioning in South Korea. He really began his political career in 1945, right after the after World War II ended and Japanese imperialism left Korea. In the 50s, he became an opposition figure, and in 1971, which is, what, 25, 26 years ago, he ran for the presidency the first time, his first time, and he got about 45% of the vote, which was a shock. He ran against Park Chung-hee, who had made a coup in 1961 and then stood for election. That particular episode caused Park Chung-hee to establish a long-lasting military dictatorship in 1972. So you're dealing with a very tough person who has suffered during his career, but who was also a politician, and by that I mean, you know, this is an honorable calling, it's not a saintly calling. One of the political moves that Kim Dae-jung just made was to reach out to the founder of the KCIA, Kim Jong-pil, who hails from another province, and make an alliance with him, which probably put Kim Dae-jung over the top in this election because he got 4 or 5 percentage points more of the vote that way. So you're dealing with a figure who will go down in history with Vaclav Havel and Mandela and Cory Aquino and various others who suffered for a long time under dictatorships, but who also is a very tough politician with wide-ranging experience over really a 50-year period.
Professor Cummings, what about today, what Kim Dae-jung faces in South Korea, taking on the $60 billion IMF loan package, which at first he opposed when he was running for president, then said he would not renegotiate?
Well, this is going to be tough for anybody to deal with because the Korean crisis is only appearing to get worse rather than better. It's bonds. You know, Standard & Poor's or Moody's just downgraded Korea's debt to basically junk debt yesterday, and the stock market is going down again. The currency has dropped a lot this week. It's not clear how anybody can solve this crisis. I think the IMF is going to have to boost its package, so on and so forth. Kim Dae-jung, as a politician, will be able to do what I think has to be done, or I hope he'll be able to do what has to be done to make people feel this pain in a fair and well-distributed manner. In other words, he has campaigned for 30 years against the huge conglomerates that dominate the Korean economy. He has sided with labor. It's not fair to say he really has a big base in labor, but he certainly can talk to labor leaders a lot better than previous rulers of South Korea have been able to do. They usually talk to them at the end of a riot baton. So I think in terms of being able to distribute the pain fairly and get labor to go along with pay cuts and layoffs that will be coming in the future, Kim Dae-jung is much better positioned to do that than either of the other two people he ran against. But it's by no means going to be easy, and it will require all of his political skills to be successful.
And Professor Cummings, where you see the won going now, the currency in South Korea, and how that fits into, to say the least, an Asian economy in general that is ailing. I mean, some may say it's good that it's ailing because it means it'll destabilize some dictators, perhaps like in Indonesia. But what do you say?
Well, I thought last week that the won had stabilized at about 1,400 to the dollar, but it's down now to 1,700 to the dollar. I think the bailout of Korea by the IMF, in which American officials like Robert Rubin, the Treasury Secretary, were heavily involved, I think they wanted to get that done quickly to establish a firebreak so that the Asian currency crisis would not go to Japan or China. And I think this week we're seeing that hasn't worked. The Japanese stock market went down dramatically yesterday, and the leadership there seems to be dithering just as the Korean leadership did. Japan is a creditor nation and not a debtor nation, and that makes a big difference. But the Japanese have not shown any ability to get themselves out of a long-running recession. So I think the ramifications of the Asian economic difficulties are going to last well into the new year and probably affect American companies as well. I do think also that there's a significant chance in Korea that there will be serious disorders, particularly by labor. I hope that with Kim Dae-jung as president that can be avoided, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit to see serious protest in Korea. After all, last January, a year ago, after the current president, Kim Il-sung, had tried to ram through an anti-labor bill at 6 a.m. in the morning, you had a virtual general strike in Korea through much of January. Labor is very strong in Korea, and it really, I think Korea is the place where you will see the IMF remedy for the Asian nations tested dramatically, because it has a stronger civil society than, I would say, even Japan, let alone a dictatorship like Indonesia.
Well, Professor Cummings, I want to thank you very much for that brief explanation about what's happening now in South Korea, particularly after the remarkable election this past week of Kim Dae-jung, a well-known Korean dissident. Professor Bruce Cummings of East Asian History at the University of Chicago and author of Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go domestic and look at a national issue. Actually, it's happening in Washington State, where supporters of a ballot initiative to abolish affirmative action are feverishly trying to gather 180,000 signatures by January 2nd. If the magic number is reached, the state legislature, which is Republican-controlled, would either have to pass the measure or pass it on to voters for their consideration. Washington could then follow California as one of the first states in the nation to outlaw affirmative action in hiring, contracts, and education. But opponents say that the Initiative 200 campaign has been falsely luring black workers into the signature-gathering campaign as a way to counter the perception that the initiative would be a setback for many people of color. And we're joined right now by two people intimately involved in this case. Kathleen Russell, campaign manager of No Initiative 200, which has been fighting the ballot measure that would abolish affirmative action. And we're also joined by Sherry Bockwinkel. She is the owner of Washington Initiatives Now, and that is the group that is gathering the petitions for the Anti-Affirmative Action Initiative. Well, why don't we start with Sherry Bockwinkel. Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us what this initiative says and how you're gathering the petitions and the signatures on them.
Okay, excuse me, it's Initiative 200, it's Initiative 200, and we're out collecting signatures to end preferential treatment in giving out jobs based on race or gender. And I'm one of many groups working on getting the signatures. I'm one of the contractors who was involved in retaining people from around the country in order to meet some of the goals and deadlines of the signature requirements.
And Kathleen Russell, what is your problem with Initiative 200? I mean, the name of your group is pretty direct. No Initiative 200.
That's right, Amy. We are concerned that this is obviously part of a broader national strategy, which is deceiving voters. It deceived voters in California. People who supported affirmative action ended up voting for Proposition 209. This is, you know, a very deceptive and misleading initiative that was drafted in a misleading way, and now we see the backers of I-200 misleading and deceiving the signature gatherers who they're hiring to get signatures.
Well, Amy, I would just like to say that's completely a false statement. We're very careful in what we do in our training methods, and people who come across the country in this business, which sounds odd to some people, but there are people who travel around the country. It's called a circuit, and I call them horses. And they get along with other people, and they come along, and they go places to work. And Dee Jones, who happened to be an African-American woman, happened to hire some other people. Their race and gender I have no knowledge of. And these people come into work. Some people, unfortunately, came here to Seattle because it's an interesting place to visit, and so we oftentimes get people who come here simply to vacation rather than to work. And a few of them got fired, and they happened to be African-American.
Yeah, actually, these folks quit gathering signatures after
there's a police
folks
report,
on the street
Kathleen,
explained to them that this was not a pro-civil rights measure, that this was anti-affirmative action.
Let's do it one at a time. Why don't we? I just wanted to clarify one thing. Who are you saying you call horses, Sherry Bockwinkel?
Crew chiefs, people in the industry who have done this, like Dee Jones, who have done this for 5 years. And let me clarify this. They were fired. There's a police report, and these disgruntled workers fired. And after they got fired, there's a letter going in today to the NAACP, in order to clarify this matter, because when the issue was brought to them, Dee Jones was never even contacted, the person who fired them. And that's all in documentation, which, you know, we intend to get out into the public, because Kathleen seems to not want to let this issue die, because it is simply an issue of workers who were fired.
And they were fired because?
They didn't produce signatures. They got here, and they were here for a week, and in a week's time, a petitioner is supposed to collect 1,000 signatures. And these individuals, as I understand it, did not do that, so Dee fired them, which is common in the business.
Kathleen Russell, your take on this?
My take on this is based on the actual stories of these five individuals who happened to call the NAACP as they were being forcibly evicted from their hotel room for saying that they no longer could, in good conscience, gather signatures for this initiative. And I'd like to say part of the reason that we are not letting this die is because the supporters of Initiative 200 have been playing the race card with this campaign from day one, completely focusing on race, and to the denial of the fact that white women in Washington State make up over half of the voters and also are equally targeted with Initiative 200. And, you know, we're also quite distressed at the types of slurs that Ms. Bockwinkel has put forth in the New York Times and the Seattle Times, invoking these untrue stereotypes used against African Americans for centuries, calling her workers liars, lazy, and saying that they can't read, I just think is a real outrage.
We're going to continue this discussion in just 1 minute, but we do have to break. Our guests are Kathleen Russell. She's the campaign manager of No Initiative 200, which is fighting the ballot measure in Washington State that would abolish affirmative action. And Sherry Bockwinkel, who is the owner of Washington Initiatives Now, which is the company that hired out-of-state workers to come in to gather signatures for the petition drive that would put Initiative 200 on the ballot, or have the legislature there vote on this initiative against affirmative action. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Kathleen Russell, campaign manager of No Initiative 200, fighting a ballot measure that would abolish affirmative action. And as well, Sherry Bockwinkel, who is owner of Washington Initiatives Now, that's currently embroiled in a controversy. It's the company that has hired out-of-state workers to come into Washington State to gather signatures for petitions for this anti-affirmative action petition drive. Sherry Bockwinkel, I wanted to ask you just about the whole philosophy of going out of the state to get these people who gather signatures. Isn't the whole idea of a state initiative is to sort of to exercise democracy at a state level and to go for something people in the state would like? Why do you have to go outside the state to find people who would gather signatures?
Well, it's kind of a funny thing in our industry. It seems that people never allow enough time to get their signatures. And the way it works is most people, most campaigns, hire professionals in some manner to get onto the ballot. And one tried and true way is to hire petition circulators. Just like in our state, people like to eat apples. Well, we bring in people from all over to pick our apples. Well, this is an issue that needs to get onto the ballot. I've been in charge of trying to get it onto the ballot and get people in here and train them in a timely fashion to meet our deadline.
Now, you have quite a record on these kinds of initiatives and getting these getting these measures on the ballot. What other initiatives have you been involved with?
Oh, geez, I've been in the business now since 1990. I started out putting term limits on the ballot and did that a couple of times and worked on affordable denture care. I worked last season on both the Gay Rights Initiative and the Dental Hygienist.
That was an anti-gay rights initiative?
No, it was pro-gay rights.
Uh-huh.
And yes, it was a pro-gay rights initiative, 677. It went down in defeat, but they tried. Let's see, I've worked on 10 now, and I'm very selective in what I work on because I do have a special talent for getting these things onto the ballot. I've never missed. And so when I do take on a project, I'm serious about it, and we go out and get the job done.
Well, the piece in the New York Times about this case, to say the least, is very damning. It starts as migrant labor goes, the signature gathering campaign against affirmative action in Washington State seemed to offer just what Arthur Tillis of Chicago said he was looking for, a chance to earn some Christmas money and see a different part of the country. But Tillis, who said he was homeless, had no sooner arrived in Seattle last week than he realized that being a trench worker in modern democracy was not at all what he expected. He said in an interview with the New York Times, I was getting cursed at by people, having a lot of trouble getting signatures. I finally read the thing carefully and said, wait a minute, this is against affirmative action. It's not a civil rights thing like it says. As one of five blacks transported by bus to Washington State by the supporters of a ballot issue that would end most affirmative action policies in Washington, Tillis said he'd never been told the true nature of the campaign, but was told he could earn up to $600 a week at 90 cents a signature. All five of the black signature gatherers interviewed told a similar story. It goes on to talk about how they not only were not getting, they're working for affirmative action, but against something they say they didn't know, but that they, in fact, weren't getting the 90 cents a signature they were promised because room and board was being taken out of those 90 cents a signature. And that when they said they wanted to go home, they were told that they actually owe you money.
They don't owe me any money. Dee Jones was their crew chief who had an independent contract agreement with these folks. And what I'd like to add is what people are focusing on here is some bad apples in our industry. They didn't do the job and they got fired, and then they went out and were able to cause a ruckus over it. I'd like to point to some of our success stories, people who literally are people of color and minorities and women who sought me out to work on this initiative. Bob Jones was quoted in the Seattle Times, who happens to be from L.A., same issue. He was told, these people, what I have to drive home here, people do not get on a bus and travel halfway across the country and not know what side of the issue you're on. That is totally unbelievable for any petitioner who does this professionally. So someone misled someone. I'm not sure. I think perhaps what's happening is these petitioners are misleading the public on this issue because they can see that it's working in their favor.
Those that said they wanted to go home, would you provide the plane fare or bus fare back?
I was not involved in that issue. That was with Dee Jones.
And but it was your company.
It's your accountability.
Had they come to me and brought it up, had they come to me and talked to me, you betcha. You betcha.
Kathleen Russell, campaign manager of No Initiative 200, I guess your campaign has offered now to pay their way home.
Well, we provided a bus ticket to Tyrone Wells, who's an 18-year-old from Toledo, Ohio, who came out to gather signatures with the impression that, and this was what Dolores Jones had shared with him, this would put affirmative action back on the ballot. And each one of these individuals had a similar story that they were told this would put it on the ballot, and they were under the impression that affirmative action had already been repealed in Washington. Tyrone Wells was denied a bus ticket home by Dolores Jones. Three folks were paid for after they were forcibly evicted from their hotel rooms. We're, however, a shoestring campaign. We're being outspent 10 to 1 and are up against major money from Ward Connerly, and now Steve Forbes, billionaire, has put a bunch of money in to do radio ads for this campaign. We don't have the kind of resources to support not only these families' Christmases, but also bus tickets home, et cetera. I mean, I think we have a real case here of folks that are in desperate straits, that are wanting to work, that are coming out here eager to work and make money, and coming here and then finding out the promises were broken, that their hotels and meals and salaries are not forthcoming, that we've got folks owing their souls to the company store in a matter of days after
arriving.
That is
truly laughable.
And,
I'm
sorry.
Why do you say owing their souls?
I can give an example of Mr. Pro Mays, who contacted our campaign after seeing the Channel 5 news coverage of the three other individuals from the Midwest, who Ms. Bockwinkel says doesn't know much about them. They are all African American. When he saw them getting on a bus going home, he contacted us and said that he was in a similar situation. He did not want to continue to get signatures for something he could not support, and that he said worked against his community. Ms. Bockwinkel said to him on the phone that he could not leave because he owes her money, that she had given him a personal loan, and that he couldn't leave the campaign until he paid her off.
Sherry Bockwinkel?
That simply is not true. Pro Mays came to town with Willie Mays, who's been in this business for 15
Willie Douglas.
Years. Willie Douglas, I'm sorry. Came to town after he's been in this business for 15 years. And Pro Mays was an individual. Our industry must befuddle people because it is truly an unusual thing. Willie ran into, he had only met Pro twice. Pro had never petitioned before. Willie was provided all the information. Willie, too, happens to be an African-American gentleman, and he was provided a copy of the petition as well as the 7-page packet that is provided to everyone before they even collect a single solitary signature. Willie had all of that information faxed to his home prior to leaving. There is no way Pro Mays was ever misled. Pro Mays came to town and then ended up working, doing very well as a new guy. Actually was on the top hitter list. Actually recruited some volunteers. Some volunteer signatures came into my office the other day. He was doing a yeoman's job, very good at it. And he saw a way from Kathleen out when he saw this, and he decided, well, it's easier not to work. And he jumped on that bandwagon. What can I say? He was never misled. He now has caused some problems back home, but that's neither here nor there. The issue here is we need to focus on some of the people who are doing very well and the numbers of people who want to sign this. This simply gets it on the ballot. And
no, actually it gets it before the legislature, who can vote it into law.
Yes,
and the people of Washington never be afforded an opportunity to vote on this measure.
Well,
and your signature gatherers are misinforming people across Washington by saying this simply gets it on the ballot, which is a patent lie.
Historically in our state, and I know you must have done this research, there is two processes in our state for the initiative process, to the people and to the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
This happens to be the process to the legislature. Since 1914, only two times has an initiative become a law where the legislators passed it directly into law. So for you to be misleading the public and saying that this is a done deal is simply unbelievable. If anybody's ever watched our legislature, you will know that this will not go forward,
Sherry,
easily, even if it went to the legislators. You know, that's part of our process.
Sherry Bockwinkel, do you think you'll get the 180,000 signatures by January 2nd?
Oh, I'm confident, yes.
And finally, Kathleen Russell, what makes you think that if it does get to the legislature, that they will simply sign off on it?
Well, the Republican leadership of both the House and Senate have been on record in the media saying that they may want to pass this into law so that they don't confuse the ballot in November of 98,
well,
coming directly from the leadership.
Let me finish, though.
Amy, what would happen here is our state legislature normally puts things on the ballot, i.e. the Paul Allen Stadium. If they don't put it on the if Kathleen Russell can't encourage them to put it onto the ballot, then she will fail, because our lawmakers generally put hot potatoes onto the ballot.
Why don't you think you'll get it on the ballot, Kathleen Russell?
Why don't we think we'll get it on the ballot?
That the legislature would make it a ballot initiative.
Well, the legislature, I mean, is a Republican majority. The state Republican Party has had a drumbeat for many months of supporting this initiative. There's no reason to believe that they won't pass it directly into law.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We've been joined by Kathleen Russell, the campaign manager of No Initiative 200, fighting the ballot measure that would abolish affirmative action. That website there is www.no200.org. That's www.no200.org. We've also been joined by Sherry Bockwinkel, who owns the company Washington Initiatives Now, that has hired petition gatherers from around the country to come in to gather the 180,000 signatures needed by January 2nd for the Republican-controlled legislature to vote on it. The next few minutes before we go to another story, Tawana Brawley, case number two, Tawana Brawley case revisited, we have been joined by one of the people who were recruited to come to Washington State and gather those signatures. Pro Mace is with us. He joins us from Rancho Tehama, California. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us, obviously you have been involved in this swirl of controversy over the last week. Why did you go to Washington State?
I went trying to make some money for my family for Christmas. I was explained to by a gentleman that I met here, an Afro-American guy, that said I'd be able to make at least $1,400 in 2 weeks or more.
And what did you understand you were going to Washington to do?
Well, I was told that I was going to help get something back on the ballot, I-200, a civil rights petition thing. It didn't say what. It just said I-200, civil rights, equal rights, justice to all, petition thing. The only thing I have to do is just gather signatures, and that was it.
Would it matter to you what it said? You were going up there to be paid to gather signatures, and that money, as you said, would go to your family. What difference does it make what it was for?
Well, I mean, at the time, if I was explained to right, I don't know, maybe I would consider because I need money, you know, for my family. But after being misled when I got up there, you know, and found out different, then that's when the confusion came in.
Well, what did happen when you came to Washington State and just started to gather those signatures?
Well, the only thing I was taken to the lady that you mentioned, Sherry's office, and I was just given some PNs, rubber bands, and petition sheet, and cardboard that you hold the sheets on with, and just sent out in the field to gather names.
And so when did the problem begin?
The problem began when I started going out in the field and finding out that it wasn't for just civil rights. It was against affirmative action.
What did people tell you?
Well, most people didn't tell me nothing. They looked at me crazy. Some came by and snared at me. Some came by and said they should spit on me. Do I know what I'm doing? Do you know what you're doing to yourself? Do you know what this means? And et cetera, you know.
Sherry Bockwinkel said that you were all fired because, well, basically you were incompetent. You weren't gathering enough signatures. And your complaints now are simply because you're disgruntled. You're upset about being fired.
Well, Sherry didn't fire me. I quit. She did not fire me at all. I quit. She said I couldn't leave from there because I owed her money. I wanted to leave after I found out that I was doing something that against my will, and she did not fire me.
Why couldn't you leave?
Well, she said I owed her some money from the time I was getting money for hotel rooms and food and all this.
But I thought you were promised money for coming to Washington
State.
That's
what I thought also, you know, and come to find out that it wasn't like that. It was just a thing that is a trick.
Well, were you getting paid 90 cents a signature?
She said I was getting paid 90 cents for signature.
But what was actually happening?
Well, I was paying her.
For what?
For the money that I was borrowing from her. I mean, I never did see none of the money. I mean, as far as the money that I was getting, I had to use for hotel room, food, and if you can read, if you had a copy of the petition itself, it says that we get 75 cents per name, 15 cents for hotel room. Now, I don't know how 15 cents for a hotel room can pay for a person, you know, staying that long of length of a time. But I wasn't getting nothing, really. I mean, it all added up to 90 cents, all because, I mean, she made it look like it was a secret that we, just me and Willie, the one that recruited me up, she made it look like just me and him was getting this 90 cents. She said, like she was doing us a favor, but it wasn't. So nobody never did tell me that I had to pay for the next week of my hotel room. Nobody didn't tell me I had to pay for food because, really, I was just eating some food that I had carried up there myself. And when I ran out of that, then Willie, he himself, he was, like, buying stuff here and there. But still, when he got to the point that I found out that I was misled by him coming up there, he stopped feeding me. You know, so then I had to go to Sherry to ask for money.
And so how did you end up parting ways with Washington Initiatives now?
Well, just all of a sudden, I called this organization. I called Channel 5 in Washington, and they recommended me to some people that might be able to help me after I seen the people being bussed from there before. And I talked to these people, and the people asked me to leave. Well, at the time, I couldn't leave because I was confused about the money that I owed to Sherry. And plus, I needed money still for my family for Christmas. I mean, I'm going up there with nothing and coming back with a worse problem than I had. And I just decided to quit. I called it quits. I called the office of No 200, and I asked for help.
And how did they help you?
Well, they recommended me to an organization down there, and they helped me out as far as recommended me to some people that could help me.
Uh-huh. And so you were eventually able to go back home to California?
Yeah, eventually.
Did they pay your way back?
This organization that they recommended me to.
Mm-hmm.
They it's a black organization that helps people in need as far as getting them in shelters and stuff like this and whatever.
But Washington Initiatives Now would not pay your way back home.
Well, they offered, you know, but I refused. You know?
They did eventually offer.
Yeah, they did offer from Jump Street. I just refused.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Promace. Again, formerly a petition drive worker, a person who gathered signatures for anti-affirmative action petitions in Washington state. This is about Initiative 200, which if the 180,000 signatures are gotten by January 2nd, the legislature, the Washington state legislature, can vote this initiative into law. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, 10 years ago, many of you heard the story, the allegations of a brutal rape and assault of a black teenager named Tawana Brawley. Rape that was alleged. She was found in a garbage bag smeared with feces with racial slurs written on her body. This was a story that shook not only New York, but in many ways a lot of the country. She accused a gang of white men of doing this. This is a story that also propelled three activists to national prominence. Today, Alton Maddox, C. Vernon Mason, and former New York mayoral candidate Reverend Al Sharpton now face a defamation lawsuit by one of the men they accused of assaulting and raping Tawana Brawley back in November of 1987. Stephen Pagonis, a former assistant district attorney in Dutchess County, New York, is seeking $365 million in damages from the three defendants. We're joined now by two people to discuss this story. The case is now in court. We're joined by Utrice Lead, who substituted for me this summer. I want to thank her again for that. Host of WBAI Pacifica Radio's afternoon talk show called Talk Back. Utrice has covered the case extensively since it broke in 1987, and she was managing editor of a newspaper in New York called the City Sun. Her newspaper articles from the time have been entered into evidence in this current defamation trial. We're also joined on the telephone by E.R. Shipp, a columnist with the New York Daily News and a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She co-authored the book Outrage, the Tawana Brawley Hoax. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's delighted to be with you.
Well, why don't we begin with you, Utrice? If you can lay out, especially for listeners around the country who aren't getting as detailed information day in and day out now about the slander case against the three representatives at the time of Tawana Brawley, Alton Maddox, C. Vernon Mason, and the Reverend Al Sharpton.
Well, it's an interesting case in that it is the only surviving charge of a very lengthy action that Stephen Pagonis had contemplated bringing against the defendants. A judge had thrown out the bulk of the initial action that Pagonis had initiated, and the defamation suit is the thing that has survived. Stephen Pagonis is alleging that Al Sharpton, C. Vernon Mason, and Alton Maddox, and Tawana Brawley deliberately set out to defame him and named him despite the facts at the time that he was in no way connected with the attack or the alleged attack on Tawana Brawley. He bolsters his view by saying that, of course, he was exonerated, quote-unquote, by a grand jury, which is a very interesting process, and we could get to that in a later part of this discussion. And the case is now before the court. The court has ruled that it is normally accepted that in a defamation trial, truth is the defense. except that the judge in this case earlier had decided that the truth would be the grand jury report which exonerated Stephen Pagonis. The judge has reversed himself on that, saying that they can now argue truth as a defense. And
that they would not use the grand jury report, which these three representatives of Tuana Borelli at the time had said that they would not cooperate with.
Right. But also, apart from saying that the grand jury report would stand as the truth, this is the earlier ruling by the judge, the judge also prohibited them from calling certain witnesses to establish their claim that in no way they defamed Stephen Pagonis. So it's it is a very interesting case from a legal standpoint.
E.R. Shipp, what is your take on this current case, what you could call the Tuana Borelli trial part two? Although there wasn't a trial the first time around. Tuana Borelli, who went on to become a college student, I believe, at Howard University, returned to New York for a big rally for the men who advised her 10 years ago, was standing next to one of them, Alton Maddox, in a church in Brooklyn to show her support before this trial began.
I feel like the Grinch who's stealing your Christmas, because I don't accept the subtext to the version of the story you've just laid out. The facts are as you said, as you said, but there's an undercurrent here that that the system is wronging the advisors, that Tuana is telling the truth, and I would differ. It may be a matter of nuance, but I think I'm differing with you guys on this, so let me try it. I see that we don't know what Tuana's story is. We know that there were people who spoke or said they spoke for Tuana back 9 or 10 years ago. Those three people who most often said they were speaking for her are the people on trial now, Vernon Mason, Alton Maddox, and Al Sharpton. We haven't really heard Tuana's story, so people need to keep that in mind. The trial that's going on now is by someone whose name surfaced by people who, even up to this point in the trial, can't seem to explain why they surfaced his name, what amount of investigation they had done before saying that he had done the things they claimed he had done. The story that goes out often is that Tuana said she was abducted and raped by six white criminal justice people. Six white law enforcement people. That's the press embellishing upon the factoids that the advisors gave us that were themselves, I think, embellishments upon what they gleaned from what Tuana's family told them. And you hear so far that's like four levels removed from whatever Tuana might have said. I don't think we know Tuana's story, and I am uncomfortable with us basing a lot of our reactions and our actions on a story that we don't know.
Well, at the same time, I appreciate what Shipp has said, but at the same time, we have the issue actually being crystallized and ignored at the same time. We have a situation here in which an accusation is made.
What is the accusation?
The accusation that Tuana Borelli had made about being kidnapped.
That Tuana Borelli's advisors said she made?
Well, even so.
Okay.
Even so.
Let's keep it clear, though.
No, but even so, because I do know that she had written White Cop.
White Cop, but that was when she was in a hospital.
But here we are discussing.
Wait. That was in a hospital where she was being asked who she would speak to about what had happened.
No, that's not correct.
No. It was in that
setting.
But in
any event, let me make my point. The point is that in any circumstance, even a circumstance in which a person allegedly is lying, the criminal justice system turns predictably to deliver justice. I mean, we had a man murder his wife at point blank range in a car in Boston, and the system worked predictably to prove that that did not happen. Here we had a case in which every effort was made to subvert the process Not by the advisors. The advisors are not empowered by the state apparatus to prosecute a case. They're not responsible for investigation. They simply are responsible for representing their client, who, by the time the advisors had come on the scene, it was well within the second month of this occurrence, and the NAACP initially had been advising Tawana Brawley, and by then the family had made a decision that the refusal of the local Dutchess County DA to have the family view mugshots, as it were, of the local police, the fact that the investigation was decidedly lackluster in the beginning forced the family to come to the conclusion that this was not going to be a vigorous investigation, and they decided not to cooperate, which is also their right.
They can have that right, but they can't come back and say that there was no investigation. There was an investigation.
It was
the grand jury, which you also...
But you should know...
Wait, let me speak a minute.
Uh-huh.
The grand jury that you also subtly criticized in your opening remarks, the grand jury did the best it could with the evidence before it. It gave everyone an opportunity to come before it. Now, everyone knows, I hope, that when one goes before a grand jury, it's considered a secret proceeding in that sense. So it's not as if you have to declare yourself before the press cameras before you go and talk to a grand jury. People had an opportunity to talk to the grand jury. The Brawley family had an opportunity. The advisors had an opportunity, particularly Reverend Sharpton. The lawyers may have not wanted to do that. There were many opportunities to go before the grand jury, but they deliberately subverted the possibility of a grand jury finding of anything that might lead to the arrest of someone who did something to Tawana.
And this is part of the public propaganda about this case.
I don't think
if
it's
anybody
propaganda.
But wait a minute. If you are any way familiar with the operations of a grand jury...
And I am.
Good. Then it should occur to you that a grand jury's job is not to find out whether a crime was committed.
Oh, yes, it is.
A grand jury's job is to make a link between a crime that has been committed and a person or persons likely to have committed that crime. But here we had in the open. No, not yet.
But you trace one thing. You could have
here we
you trace one just one point on this one. And that is that you can have two kinds of grand juries.
Yeah.
One is a grand jury that decides whether to indict.
There's an investigative grand jury.
And one is an investigative.
An
investigative grand jury is rarely convened because most of the time we know that a crime has occurred. We have a victim. We have, you know, evidence and all that. So all they need to do is to say that the person that the prosecutors and the cops are bringing before them is likely to be the person who did it.
An investigative grand jury
is historically the way we've always used grand juries.
No, an investigative grand jury looks usually into matters of official misconduct. Now, unless people are making the argument that rape is a function of public office, I do not understand why an investigative grand jury
turn of phrase
was
but that's not accurate.
But the point I'm making, an investigative grand jury
has the right to investigate, and around the country, outside of New York.
Uh-huh.
Around the country, outside of New York, investigative grand jurors look into a lot of things. They look into how the jails are being run.
Right.
They look
public
into
policy.
How, no, no, no.
Public policy.
Into, no, all of this is public policy
sure.
when you get down to
in,
it.
In New York State, this is how investigative grand juries function.
When somebody comes forward and says a crime has been committed and they don't have anything to back it up, like a body or anything, the investigative grand jury then can subpoena and do all kinds of forensic
no, that is a prosecutorial grand jury, which is very different.
No, no, no.
Well, look, we are arguing about this.
I don't want to confuse you. That's why I try not to get into this stuff.
No, I'm saying that here we have the issue here is not whether Tawana Brawley is telling the truth or not.
Let's do this one at a time.
If Tawana Brawley is telling the truth, if she's lying about everything that has ever, you know, occurred in her life until now, a jury is easily the forum within which the jury determines innocence or guilt.
No, it doesn't.
I am troubled. The case is most troubling to me because here we have the demand that a black girl pre-qualify for justice. This black girl has had to prove every element or was required to prove every element of her claim in order that the apparatus of justice should evaluated to see whether she qualified for the system to work. And that is the greatest atrocity in this case.
E.R. Schiff,
I disagree with that view.
Why don't you lay out what your view of the case is? We just have a few minutes now, but your view of that case and this case now, the case of Tawana Brawley's original allegation and then the slander case today brought by one of the men that she accused against her advisors.
I don't accept that Tawana Brawley has ever given us an allegation. I hear that people have spoken for her, so that's a starting point. A lot of people have said a lot of things for Tawana. Tawana has only come forward twice, as I can tell, in public and said, I'm not a liar, I'm not crazy. She said that in 1988. She said that a few weeks ago in Brooklyn.
Were you able to interview her for your book?
She was not available to anybody, even when I rode on a bus.
She was available to me.
Even when I rode on a bus in a hellacious situation going from New York to Atlanta for the Democratic Convention in 88, I could not speak to Tawana. Now, Tawana,
she
it turns out, is a distant cousin of mine. Now, I've just discovered that after all this hellacious trying to cover the Tawana Brawley story. So maybe one day I will talk to her at a family reunion, but that day has not yet occurred. Now, this is the deal. I think that the advisors, so-called, to Tawana, deliberately kept her and the truth from the public. And they've left us wrestling over what we all know to have happened in the past, in some instances, in the South mostly. That is to say that we all know there have been these horrific instances of abuse, rape, killings, lynchings, all this stuff. We can all come up with some stories about this. And for a lot of people, it's enough to say that Tawana triggered that memory, that latent memory somehow. But it's not the truth necessarily in this case. And I think that everybody, I don't see Tawana's story as a black story, by the way. I think everybody who cares about justice should be willing to question those who claim that they have been wronged, just as much as we question those who they say have wronged them. And in this case, it seems to me, too many people are willing to just rely upon that trigger memory that something bad happened in the South that our grandmas told us about, that our mothers and fathers told us about, and we're not holding Tawana to that standard of truthfulness, and we're not holding her so-called advisors to a level of truthfulness.
Well, I'm very clear about one thing. This is hardly an emotional reaction. This is a very, cut and dried issue of whether the system operated in a dichotomous way, and it did. It has, and it continues to. The Tawana Brawley case is very important to the African-American community, not because of what grandmas went through in the South, although that is not to be discarded, but because the system of justice continues to operate at a disadvantage for people of color, and especially black women. And we need to focus not on Tawana Brawley so much, although that is going to be inevitable, but on the system that insists on denying her rights.
Well, I'm willing to focus on the system, but I'm not willing to focus on it as denying her rights.
Well,
I don't see that it denied her any rights.
Well, I hope this... Yatrice and E.R. Schiff, I hope this can be the part one of this discussion, because the case resumes after the holidays on January 5th in New York, and we will continue to follow it. We hope we can have both of you back as commentators on that case, the slander case brought by one of them and accused by Tawana Brawley of raping her, and he is now put her representatives on trial. I want to thank you both for being with us. E.R. Schiff, a columnist from the New York Daily News, wrote a book on the Tawana Brawley case, and Yatrice Leed of WBAI Pacifica Radio. Dan Coughlin produced today's show. Errol Maitland was our engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.